This is The Guardian.
Today, how a right-wing majority on the US Supreme Court is changing America.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.
The biggest setback to gay rights in America in recent years has its origins way back in September 2016, when a woman named Laurie Smith, who designs websites, filed a legal challenge against anti-discrimination laws in her state, Colorado.
Well, I am a custom graphic and website designer. I create unique, one-of-a-kind websites and speech. And yes, I want to design for weddings, and I want to design in a way that's consistent with my faith. But Colorado is censoring and compelling my speech and forcing me to create custom artwork, custom expression that goes against the core of who I am and what I believe.
Smith, who's a Christian, was worried that these laws would mean that if a gay couple ever asked her to design a website for their wedding, a very specific concern, I know, it would be illegal for her to say no.
My case is not only about me and my artwork, but also protecting the LGBT artist or graphic designer who should not be forced to create custom artwork that opposes same-sex marriage.
But there was a key problem in her lawsuit. And that problem was that no one had ever asked her to provide a website for a same-sex wedding. She actually hadn't gotten a request to do the thing that she feared was going to happen.
Sam Levine, a reporter with Guardian US, has been covering the case.
And you can see why that's problematic for her lawsuit. She needs to show that she suffered some harm, that she's being penalized or being forced to do something that she doesn't want to do in order to have a case.
But as luck would have it, that problem was quickly solved. The day after Smith filed her lawsuit, a message appeared in her inbox.
This is what the message says. My wedding. My name is Stuart and my fiancé is Mike. We are getting married early next year and would love some design work done for our invites, place names, etc. We might also stretch to a website. And so her lawyers start pointing to that to say, hey, look, she did get this inquiry and she has, in fact, suffered the type of injury that allows her to bring a lawsuit.
Smith's case was dismissed by a court in Colorado, but over the next years, her appeals made their way up through America's court system. And late last year, the case was heard by the US Supreme Court, and they would make the final decision.
But the day before the Supreme Court issued its ruling, a twist emerged. A reporter from a news magazine called The New Republic got in touch with this man called Stuart, who filed this inquiry with the website designer. And this reporter asked Stuart what he made of the fact that his email had gone all the way to the Supreme Court, that it played this, you know, sort of critical role in the case. And to her surprise, Stuart said he had no idea that his name was being used in the case, that he had actually never sent this inquiry, and that beyond that, he had been happily married to a woman for the last 15 years. So last week, I dug up the court filing from Stuart, and the filing has his email address and phone number. And I sent him an email to the email that's listed, and he responded pretty quickly. And when we spoke, he didn't seem angry. He seemed more just sort of in disbelief disbelief, I think, in both that his name had been used in this way and disbelief that it had taken this long for anyone to track him down.
I mean, that is an incredible twist in this case. And amazing that it comes out the day before the court makes its decision last week. What did the court end up deciding?
The court, in a 6-3 decision, wound up ruling in favor of the website designer. And it said that Colorado cannot compel her to serve people if she has a religious objection to it.
So, Sam, I have to ask, if it wasn't Stuart who sent that message, who did?
We don't know. And we might never know.
So the message at the heart of this case might have been a prank or completely fake, but its consequences are very real. And a year after these same judges took away the right to abortion, it was one of several decisions handed down last week that will reshape the lives of millions of Americans. Donald Trump may never set foot in the White House again, we can hope, but his legacy is already becoming clear. A right-wing majority on the Supreme Court that could rule for decades, and which Joe Biden and the Democrats do have a way to stop. But it's risky. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, a legal revolution in America and what Joe Biden can do about it. So Sam, what did the Supreme Court actually say in the Lori Smith case? And what kinds of consequences is it going to have for gay and queer Americans?
The Supreme Court's ruling in the Lori Smith case really comes down in favor of religious belief as a key principle in American life. And it essentially says that she has a right to refuse service, to announce a policy refusing service based on her religious beliefs. And there are deep, deep concerns about the implications for that in American life. How far can you extend that principle? Can someone object to serving a racial minority if they have a religious objection? Can someone object to serving someone of a different religion? And the concern is that this decision has given cover to people to discriminate against gay people, against all other types of minorities, if they simply say, I have a religious objection to doing this. And in the dissent, you know, Sonia Sotomayor, a Supreme Court justice who was appointed by President Obama, really went to lengths to point out how much of a setback this will be for gay Americans. And she points out that things like interracial marriage, which used to be banned in the United States, were once justified on the basis of religious beliefs, and read that dissent from the bench at the Supreme Court for several minutes, which is something that rarely happens at the court and something that justices use to signal when they strongly disagree with the majority opinion.
That's a really concerning decision from the Supreme Court, but it isn't the only one with implications for people's equality that was delivered last week. Tell me about the other case that the court ruled on.
We'll hear argument next in case 20-1199, Students for Fair Admissions versus the President and Fellows of Harvard College.
The court last week also delivered a key decision in a case dealing with affirmative action in college admissions in the U.S.
So that's the idea that if you're from a minority background, an underrepresented background, you might stand a better chance at getting into a college like Harvard or Columbia or any college across the country.
That's right.
Asians should be getting into Harvard more than whites, but they don't because Harvard gives them significantly lower personal ratings. What Harvard is doing to Asians, like what it was doing to Jews in the 1920s, is shameful, but it's a predictable result of letting universities use race in highly subjective processes.
And the Supreme Court said that affirmative action is unconstitutional. This is a huge decision from the Supreme Court, basically ending that way of evaluating applicants.
How did that case come about?
This case was supported by a man named Edward Blum, who has emerged as a key figure in the conservative movement in bringing cases that challenge the use of race-conscious policies to achieve equality.
Your race and your ethnicity should not be used to help you or to harm you in your life's endeavors, whether you're applying for a job, a college, or a medical school.
He was involved in another case that dealt with college admissions at the University of Texas, and now is involved in this case that it deals with affirmative action. And a consistent principle in all of these cases that Mr. Blum has been involved in is deep skepticism of the use of race to elevate certain groups above others. There's a deep skepticism that race-conscious policies continue to be needed in American life today.
And so what does Blum think universities should be doing instead?
I think what he would say is that everyone should be looked at race blind.
Do you use the phrase colorblind?
Well, I do. Just as the founders of the modern civil rights movement used colorblind.
Everyone should go into the college admissions process on equal footing.
But that seems to fly in the face of the reality that race does exist. It does shape the outcomes of people's lives. So why would you want to end a program that tries to take that into account and counteract its worst effects?
Well, this gets at one of the real divisions at the Supreme Court in recent years. And this is a division over the role that discrimination in race continues to play in America today. And if you ask the more conservative justices in this affirmative action case and in other cases dealing with race, they have continued to paint a picture of an America that's made great strides on racial equality, where programs like affirmative action are no longer necessary to achieve the kind of racial equality that we all want. And that is really at odds with the vision of America that the three liberal justices have painted. And that's an America that certainly has made strides on racial equality, but continues to be plagued by the legacy of inequality. And in their telling, this race-conscious way of looking at college admissions and other areas is necessary to continue to make strides towards racial equality.
And that decision on affirmative action wasn't the only bombshell from the Supreme Court last Friday either. Tell me what else they decided.
Last year, President Biden introduced a policy to forgive certain amounts of student debt.
But I want to be clear who's going to benefit the most. Working people, the middle class. If you earn less than $125,000 a year, you'll get up to $10,000 knocked off your student debt.
And this was something that started during the coronavirus pandemic, and President Biden continued it last year.
Republican members of Congress are trying to do everything they can to deny this relief, even to their own constituents. As soon as I announced my administration's student debt plan, they started attacking it, saying all kinds of things.
And in its final decision of the term, the Supreme Court ended this policy 6-3. It said that the Department of Education, you know, which is an agency under President Biden, really didn't have the authority to implement this policy.
And is it a coincidence that in the last term we heard cases about affirmative action, about LGBTQ rights, about President Biden's debt cancellation policy? Or is the court deciding what cases it wants to hear and which it wants to just leave on the side?
Well, the Supreme Court does decide what cases it wants to hear. It only takes up a small, small sliver of all the cases that litigants ask it to hear. And the issues that it considers are often the most controversial issues that it wants to weigh in on. And in recent years, since there's been a conservative majority and now supermajority on the court, we've seen them weigh into increasingly controversial areas of American life.
So what does this mean for you today?
This means everything. This is the moment that we have been working towards. This is a historic day. This is the first day that America is living in a post-Roe generation.
Whether that's abortion, like we saw last year, they overturned Roe versus Wade.
And it's insane that we're going all the way back to the way things were in 1970 and that women's rights are being stripped away. And I do think that they will not stop here.
This year, affirmative action and college admissions, religious discrimination. This is a court that has signaled it is unafraid to weigh into these very controversial areas of American life.
Can you remind us how we got to what you just said is a super majority of conservative justices? How did we get to the point that this court that has so much power in American life is so packed with conservatives?
Well, the conservative supermajority on the court has really been shaped by several things. First,
we join you with this breaking news. Justice Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court's most influential conservative, has died.
In 2016, Antonin Scalia died, and that gave President Obama a chance to appoint a new justice that would have reshaped the balance of the Supreme Court. It would have gone from a 5-4 conservative court to a 5-4 liberal court.
I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to his work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence.
And President Obama put forth a nominee.
Today I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
And Republicans controlled the Senate at the time, and they refused to even consider Merrick Garland's nomination for the court.
Within minutes, Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said no. Congress will wait until a newly elected president picks a Supreme Court justice.
Our view is this. Give the people a voice in filling this vacancy.
And President Trump, of course, won the election in 2016. There was still a vacancy on the court. He filled it. That allowed the conservatives to maintain their 5-4 majority. And then a few years ago, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died.
Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died at the age of 87 from complications from metastatic pancreatic cancer, according to a statement.
And President Trump was president at the time. Again, it was close to the 2020 election. But this time, Republicans appointed a new conservative justice just days before the election.
On this vote, the yeas are 52, the nays are 48. The nomination of Amy Coney Barrett of Indiana to be an associate justice of the Supreme Court of the United States is confirmed.
So that switched the balance of the court from 5-4 conservative to 6-3 conservative, really giving the conservatives a supermajority on the Supreme Court.
So, Sam, this is a very conservative court flexing its muscles. Were there any cases brought by right-wing groups that this court didn't rule in favor of?
There were two significant rulings this term that were surprising. Both of them dealt with voting rights.
The rulings considered a big win for the Voting Rights Act in Section 2, which protects against racial discrimination in voting.
One case dealt with a challenge to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which basically outlaws voting practices that discriminate on the basis of race. And in a very surprising decision in early June, the Supreme Court actually said that the conditions were met in the specific case that they were dealing with.
And today, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision written by Chief Justice John Roberts, joined by Brett Kavanaugh and the three liberal justices, said, in fact, that Alabama's map was discriminatory, that it violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that landmark law.
And that was surprising because Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the opinion in that case, has been very hostile to voting rights, both since he's been on the court and before he got on the court when he was a lawyer in the Justice Department.
And so what do you think is behind that? That on some right-wing causes, the court happily endorses them, but when it comes to others, they surprise people by choosing not to go there?
There's been a lot of talk about this, and I think that's one of the key questions that everyone who watches the court is trying to figure out. And I talked with one law professor who I thought framed it really well. And he said that what the Supreme Court has done, and specifically what Chief Justice Roberts has done this term, has really taken the edge off the criticism that the Supreme Court is political, that it is results-oriented, and that these justices are just hacks. That by issuing these surprising rulings in these voting rights cases, it's provided the Supreme Court with a little bit of cover to be very aggressive on other issues that are very important to the conservative movement.
It sounds like this very conservative court is trying to walk a line between achieving the goals of the conservative movement that they've been appointed to those positions to achieve, and not making the court look so right-wing that it loses legitimacy in the eyes of the American public. And I'm wondering, how well do you think it's walking that line?
I think that's exactly the right way to put it. I think that the Supreme Court is really struggling with its perception that it is a conservative Republican institution. And this is something I think that was supercharged by the court's decision in the abortion case last year. It overturned the constitutional right to an abortion. I think that decision caused Americans to see the court as a political institution in ways that Americans just hadn't considered it before.
These days, it's fair to ask who really is in charge in this country, because the momentous loss of the constitutional right to abortion, which has led to state abortion bans across the country, came from a ruling by just 5 right-wing justices on the Supreme Court.
At the same time, you know, it suffered a series of ethics scandals.
And a report from ProPublica today is raising new questions about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and his financial ties to billionaire Harlan Crow. He's a prominent Republican mega donor. According to the report,
there's been excellent and continued reporting on conflicts of interest that the justice may have before parties that are coming before the court.
It's an incredible piece of investigative journalism showing that Justice Alito was treated to a major taste of the sweet life by a conservative billionaire who later had business before the court at least 10 times. Justice Alito didn't recuse himself from any of those cases.
And the court is really, I think, responding to all of this attention, all of these attacks on its credibility, and trying to figure out how to restore some of that. And I think that there's even a debate on the court that we're seeing emerge between the conservative justices on how fast the Supreme Court should move in achieving some of its goals. Someone once said to me, you know, the question on the Supreme Court is its velocity, not the direction, sort of how fast is it going to move, not where it's going.
Coming up, this conservative supermajority might dominate the court for generations. Is there anything Democrats can do about it?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
Said the Supreme Court has thrown into question its own legitimacy. Is this a rogue court?
This is not a normal court.
Sam, these three decisions, especially the one on student debt, are a blow to Joe Biden's agenda. What's been his reaction?
President Biden has been very forceful in his response to these decisions.
The court has effectively ended affirmative action in college admissions, and I strongly disagree with the court's decision.
You're right that he has not supported the Supreme Court's decisions. And in the student loan case, immediately the day they announced the decision, announced that he was going to take another stab at a modified version of the debt forgiveness program.
I'm announcing today a new path consistent with today's ruling to provide student debt relief to as many borrowers as possible, as quickly as possible. We will ground this new approach in a different law than my original plan,
which I'm sure will be challenged immediately. But as the president gears up to run for re-election, I think that this is actually an advantage to him. It gives him another cudgel he can use on the campaign trail, pointing to why voters need to re-elect him so that a future president can't appoint more conservative justices to the Supreme Court.
Does he have any other options other than just waiting for these conservative justices to retire and hoping that it's a Democratic president in the White House when they do?
I think recognizing the legacy of the Supreme Court, many Democrats have started to call for changing the makeup of the Supreme Court.
Well, the Republicans, they upset the balance on the Supreme Court. So we need to expand by two in order to get back to two seats, which were stolen, and then two more seats in order to restore the balance that had existed on the court.
So one option some Democrats have called for is adding seats to the Supreme Court, which would give President Biden more appointment.
So it's like the bully down the schoolyard. If you let the bully keep stealing your lunch money, nothing's going to stop them in the future. So the only question is, are we going to stand up to the bullies?
Another option I've heard is this idea that justices should be forced to retire after a certain number of years on the court. Supreme Court justices currently have life appointments, and there's been calls to revisit that.
The courts, if they were to proceed without any check on their power, without any balance on their power, then we will start to see an undemocratic and frankly dangerous authoritarian expansion of power in the Supreme Court, which is what we are seeing now from the overturning of—
And President Biden, it should be noted, has not embraced any of those calls so far. He has not said that the Supreme Court should be changed. He hasn't said that the Supreme Court should be expanded.
But Sam, given how powerful this majority is and how destructive they're proving to the agenda of left-wing and liberal people, why isn't Biden considering these more nuclear options, like adding judges to the bench or forcing them to retire when they reach a certain age?
President Biden, you have to remember, is an institutionalist. He was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which confirmed Supreme Court justices. So I think he certainly has a deep understanding of the court and the justices that serve on it. You know, he served in the Senate for several decades, and I think it commands a real respect for the institutions in Washington, and in various aspects of his presidency has been slow to come around to the idea that some of these institutions might be in need of change. I think there's also a concern that changing the rules for Supreme Court appointments could open up a Pandora's box. I think they recognize that President Biden and Democrats won't control the White House forever. And, you know, if they change the rules now, imagine what Republicans could do once they got into power.
But Sam, you told me about the way that Republicans prevented President Obama from putting his nominee on the Supreme Court way back in 2016. And it seems like when it comes to the Supreme Court, they play this game pretty hard. And what I wonder is, are the Democrats perhaps holding on to this idea that the Supreme Court should be above politics, that it should be a completely separate institution from the cut and thrust of partisanship and all that, while the other side doesn't see it that way at all? They recognize the Supreme Court for what it is, which is a political institution.
I think more and more there's recognition from the Democrats that this is a political institution. I think the way that Democrats are talking about the Supreme Court now is much, much different from even the way that it was talked about 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago. And I think that the public distrust of the Supreme Court, the mounting pressure over the court, both for its ethics and for the way it's going about making its decisions, you know, a court that overrules precedent in some cases that's just a few years old, I think is going to lead to very, very serious pressure from Democrats to change something about the court.
Sam, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Sam Levine, a voting rights reporter with Guardian US. For more on this story, listen to this week's Politics Weekly US, out tomorrow, where Jonathan Friedland speaks to Moira Donegan about the Democrats' options in dealing with this very conservative court. That's Politics Weekly US, and you can find it wherever you find Today in Focus. And that is it for today. This episode was produced by Alex Atak. Sound design was by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producer was Elizabeth Casson, and we'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.